Hi, I'm Gordon Lanphier, and welcome to the Real Finds podcast, the podcast that interviews key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers shaping real estate and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Scott Robinson. Scott is Senior Vice President of Corporate Development at Plymouth Industrial REIT and Director and Professor of NYU's Schack Institute. As a result, today you're in for both an intellectually and financially enriching conversation about the state of industrial real estate in 2025, how investors are navigating liquidity crunches, how e-commerce growth continues to drive logistics markets, the effect of potential tariffs, and how energy costs are a sneakily important line item for investors. If you're interested in the industrial real estate sector, this is a must listen. Scott, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. I know it's been tough to get me scheduled, so I appreciate it.
You know, always the best ones are tough to get scheduled.
You say that now.
So in terms of that, we're talking about the best market, I would say, in real estate these days, and that's primarily going to be industrial, right? And so I'm curious, let's go into like macro trends. What do you think are some of the biggest trends that you're starting to see in the market? And like, how do you think investors can kind of start to see that?
Yeah. Well, again, thanks for having me. It's been a very interesting year, probably 2.5 years for real estate in general. And I would say probably more so for industrial, because we were coming off such a sugar high during and immediately after COVID. I feel like we've kind of taken a little bit more heat than other sectors, but at least in the capital markets, fundamentals have been great for us still. I think that's starting to temper more in general, but big picture, you know, it's funny. I went to a fundraising seminar this morning. One of the big allocators was talking about allocation updates and whatnot, and they were debating between themselves if we've been through a nuclear winter the past 2 years, or just somewhere left north of the wall. Game of Thrones analogy. So it's been tough, but I would say that from an industrial perspective, a lot of the macro trends that we were looking at, you know, we'll call it a little bit before COVID, increasingly during and after COVID, those haven't really changed. I would argue, you know, maybe more from an academic point of view, that maybe some of them haven't come to fruition at the same velocity as we had all anticipated. But it's kind of hard to tell, as I said, coming off of that sugar rush that was COVID.
Yeah, I mean, the markets were, you know, use some drug language. They were coked up on absolutely a tremendous amount of liquid capital. And I think what we're seeing, at least in the Chicago market, and by Chicago market at both Illinois and Wisconsin, we're seeing a lot of buyers that are still thinking it's 2022, and a lot of sellers who think it's 2022, and a lot of buyers who now realize that we're in a very different liquidity market. How do you see that liquidity market playing out for the kind of the buyer and seller gap that we're starting to see in the market? And are you seeing in broader commercial real estate markets the gap narrowing, or are we still seeing a great divide?
Yeah, that's like the question, right? And my answer is, it depends. It depends a little bit on the geography. You know, you mentioned Chicago and lower Midwest. I think those industrial markets have been doing well, Southeast. It depends on the property type. Obviously, you know, an industrial data center, particularly versus, you know, maybe multifamily, retail has been crushing it. But more importantly, I think it kind of depends on each individual owner's seller's situation. Where they are in their asset life cycle, where they are with their capital partners life cycle. There has been, I would say, more enthusiasm, generally speaking. I think we've all seen it since the election for a number of reasons. Maybe your candidate won, maybe not. But I think having that understanding and clarity of where we might be on an outcome kind of loosened up a lot of sentiment, both, you know, capital markets, if you will, investors, but also business investment decision making. I think some numbers in the past month have tempered a little bit. If I look at some indices, But generally speaking, I think people are looking at making investment decisions, whether they're occupiers or property owners, right? And if I combine that with where certain property owners might be in their investor life cycle, their building life cycle, you're going to see more transactions this year. And there's definitely appetite to start buying again after this, you know, you want to call it nuclear winter for the past 2.5 years. Real estate people are acquisition minded and we want to get back to work. And so there's now interest to get something done. But yeah, I think your point is spot on is where is that bid-ask gap, right? And it is still pretty wide, but I think depending on the pressure and the situation, people are transacting. If I go back, I want to jump way around, but I was looking at cap rates and industrial spreads to treasuries. And I think the 2010 to 2020 average spread was something like, I should have memorized this, I think like 340 basis points. Obviously, pre-COVID industrial was a different, you know, market, different appetite. That came down to about 100, 105 basis points in early 24, even during that nuclear winter, right? I think it's probably gapped up a little bit now because things are starting to loosen up. But that's still a pretty good spread for the industrial market, right? And I think that demonstrates the appetite there. So while cap rates have gapped up a little bit more for Class B industrial versus Class A, deals are starting to get done.
Yeah, I'm curious what you're seeing from New York and kind of across your portfolio. Where would you say your portfolio is primarily located so that our listeners can get kind of a context of kind of what you're seeing within your individual markets?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, just as a quick little background, I'm SVP Corporate Development for Plymouth Industrial REIT. We're an NYSE-listed REIT. We have about 34 million square feet, primarily concentrated in the Southeast, Lower Midwest. You know, think Chicago, Columbus, Memphis, Nashville, Atlanta, Jacksonville. Really good kind of longer-term growth markets for jobs and employment and economic reasons. I'm also a clinic or adjunct professor at NYU's Master of Science program in real estate. I think today I'll keep most of my commentary more from an academic point of view. The REIT's in blackout. We've got earnings coming up and we'll just kind of keep this high level. But you know, to your question, what am I seeing across the landscape? Look, coming off of that, the COVID demand, I would say there was a couple of things that we're all still dealing with today. One was a significant increase in construction activity to meet the e-commerce driven demand, right? So really 500,000 square foot plus product type, really nationally, but a lot in top 50 markets, maybe coastal markets. And then the other one was concerns around supply chain. So occupiers' concerns there really caused them to take a lot of space, just grabbing space before rents were really ticking up too much, before vacancy was getting super tight. And I think today we've got kind of that dual overhang, right? Too much deliveries have come on market in the past year or so in the bigger box space. And I would say, generally speaking, probably similar sized ecosystem, occupiers have maybe a little more capacity than they need. So that larger segment of the industrial market is feeling more pressure. And I think, you know, vacancy there is probably closer to 10%. If I look at national averages, we're probably up to about 8% vacancy, which we haven't really seen since 2016. But if I look at shallow bay product or smaller footprint probably product, call it 100, 300,000 square foot, you're probably closer to like a 6% vacancy. So performing better, definitely a bifurcation there. So I would say broad strokes, that's kind of what we're seeing, what I'm seeing.
Where are you starting to see the most slowdown in product by product size? So like I would say for our market, typically absolutely the best is 5,000 or less. Then there's kind of another gap, that kind of a slowdown around like 25,000 feet, where like there's definitely a buyer there in the Chicago market, or at least a leaser that's kind of below 25,000 feet. And then we see like there's a big gap in product that starts to occur around 100,000 feet. Like there starts to be a big slowdown. Where are you seeing broader in the market, kind of the patterns where people can maybe, you know, determine risk allocation based on like product size?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, there's so many different ways to try to carve up and think about the industrial property ecosystem. The academic in me kind of likes what NAIOP tries to do. I think they have 11 different categories.
Yeah.
The world doesn't quite function that way. I would say it's probably three categories. We'll call it, you know, small bay flex product, you know, as you were talking about in the, we'll call it sub 75,000 square foot, sub 100,000, and then call it 100 to 300, maybe up to 400. And then above that, larger bulk distribution stuff. I think the other way to think about it is tenants per building and average tenant size, right? And so yeah. When you're looking at the under 100,000 square foot, you know, you're probably talking 4 to 10 tenants. You get down further, maybe more tenants, and they just get smaller, right? And so from both a fundamental point of view and by extension, the capital markets, that upper size range is really where the slowdown has been. I don't play in the 100,000 square foot and less space too much, but I do know there's been a lot more interest there, including at this investor symposium as at this morning, which I find really interesting because I don't know if it's a pushback from overexposure to single tenant, million square foot buildings and wanting to have that tenant diversification, but it is a benefit of having that diversified tenant base, right? There are owner operators who kind of push back on managing a building that has, you know, so many tenants or a portfolio that has so many tenants. You have shorter WALTs, which I think is good. You get that quicker mark to market, assuming that's the direction of rents. But it is more labor intensive to manage that small bay, smaller tenant portfolio. But in the right markets across the Sun Belt, you definitely have a huge array of tenants that can backfill, as opposed to a million square foot, you know, building out in Jersey somewhere. Just a quick side note, you know, if some of your listeners go back and do some research on PS Business Parks, PSBA, I think they got bought 8 to 10 years ago. I'd be off on that. But they were early players in that flex office space. And it was an underloved, underappreciated market back in the day. But they touted all the time that their average tenant size was roughly 2,800 square feet or so. Not investment grade tenants at all, but you can backfill that. You can lose a few of those. It just doesn't matter, right? So I think you're seeing more investor appetite for that product. One challenge, then I'll take a breath, is deal size. You have to start thinking about the capital markets differently when you're thinking about product type and its size, right? 50,000 square foot building, you're just not going to get large pension funds going after that product. So it's a much more granular capital market as well, which I think longer term could result in some cap rate compression as it becomes more institutionalized and certain players bulk up and they have larger portfolios that can be sold into that larger capital market.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something that we've been seeing as well. I know for us, what we see in the Chicago market, when we put product out on the market, that is what we would categorize as sub-institutional space, you know, 25, 50,000 feet, multi-tenant buildings. You just get a flurry of basically private equity coming in, trying to acquire it. And I think there's been a huge shift, at least in the Chicagoland market. And I can only speak for Chicago and Wisconsin because that's where we're based out of. But it's all people who I think are trying to get away from the traditional capital markets and allocate smaller size capital. So it'll be fascinating to see, as you put it, when we see a transition for maybe more large size funds getting into that space, because I think that'll shake things up.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about something else that's shaking things up, though. And I know you mentioned that we have more certainty now that the election is over. And whoever won, you know, I know there are people listening to this who are either very happy or very mad about the election. But one of the things that is uncertain and I hear all the time from both buyers and sellers is potential threat of tariffs. And how are you seeing that play out in the capital markets overall? And like, what do you foresee it affecting the market in general?
Yeah, look, I think good investors are generally a little more cautious, surveying landscape, waiting a few minutes before jumping, rather than just moving very quickly. You still get an outsized return, you still generate alpha, but you're taking a little bit less risk, right? And I think that's kind of where the landscape is today. There's really no clear answer on what tariffs do, how they flow through the economy, how they flow through price structures. It's totally different on every type of product, depending on who in that supply chain can do what, where their existing margins are, who they're selling to, so on and so forth. So there is no blanket answer of what tariffs are going to do, right? So that may not be a politically happy answer for some on either side, but that's just the reality of it. And so as a result, it's tough to say how that's going to impact the property markets, the capital markets, and maybe specifically industrial. But, you know, I was having a conversation with a manufacturer who has operations in Canada and the U.S. And, you know, they have the ability to flex some of their production into the U.S. Okay, great. And if they do that, then shouldn't necessarily harm their business, right? And weirdly, that's kind of one of the points of the tariffs, at least academically, is to bring more manufacturing closer to home, right? In this case, I guess, directly back into North America. And so interesting, like that will have that outcome. But that's just one case, right? Not everybody can do that. And it does take a long time to move, if you don't already have a manufacturing capacity here, to move that to the U.S., right? I think you need to weigh the cost of transport and tariffs against higher labor costs and whatever duration it takes to get your factories up and running in the U.S. to see which way makes sense. But I think Harry Mosler has an index. The Reshoring Initiative is his platform, just to give him a little bit of a shout out, I guess. He's been looking at that index over the past 10 or 12 years or so. And it's basically close to neutral coming in from Asia without tariffs. And so in his mind, while we've all been talking about reshoring, nearshoring, onshoring, whichever segment or language you want to use, and there's been a little bit of that here and there, I do think that's moving in the right direction. I think if tariffs are going to become more definitive, kind of longer term aspect of the landscape, you will see more of that production coming into the U.S. We've been seeing in the past, you know, 5 years or 4 years because of supply chain issues coming back to North America, right, which has really benefited Texas markets and other border markets. So long-winded answer there. I think it will have net positive impact on the U.S. industrial property market. I don't really see the case for it having a negative impact, right? One caveat to that is I was speaking earlier this week to the head of retail real estate for a large retailer. They've got a couple big e-commerce bulk distribution facilities. One, they've spent a significant amount of money modernizing to reduce their exposure to permanently higher labor costs in the U.S. I think that's going to be an issue, but what are they doing? They're investing in technology, into infrastructure inside the building, which if they don't own that space, it makes them a much stickier tenant. But they're also, it demonstrates their thinking about cost of occupancy. I think real estate property owners, whether it's office, industrial, we're pretty good at saying that we're a small component to an occupier's expense structure. I don't know that that's definitively always true, especially if you start looking at energy costs, their utility charges, and especially property taxes, and kind of think more holistically about that occupier's cost of that space. I think it's gone up. I'm not saying that doesn't leave room for rent growth still, but I think it is part of the picture, and there's going to be more thinking about that occupier's expense of being there. So maybe I'll close with, it's not fait accompli that everybody's going to be moving into the U.S. for more manufacturing. But I think net-net, it's probably neutral to positive, the tariff impact.
So let's talk about one thing that we know for sure is probably likely to continue to grow, and that's probably e-commerce, right? I would say, you know, you can argue about how much it's going to grow, but you know, if you go by anybody's porch, and I don't care if it's New York or Chicago or LA, you're going to see an Amazon package. So I'm curious, how are you seeing e-commerce growth, same day delivery evolving kind of over the next year? And how are you looking at that generally from both a portfolio perspective and kind of just an observer in the market as a professor?
Yeah, I appreciate that last caveat. Thank you. look, I think we can all read the stats. I think e-commerce hit 23% of total retail sales last year. I think it's expected to hit 25% or more. I think those stats really kind of speak to where absorption of that big box product that's been delivered, you know, the past 18 months, where that absorption is going to go. It might take, you know, a year and a half for that to totally absorb. But I think you kind of see that tailwind there over the medium term. But I think your point's more interesting than just that, right? Because you're really talking about our experience in e-commerce. And for me, as somebody who lives in the city, and I know my students are the same, I care more about having it. Like, do I want to get it in a few days? Well, no, I want it now. Why? I don't know. I don't need that toothpaste today. If I did, I could just go downstairs to CVS and get it, right? But it's just more convenient. And so I think the supply chain continues to work toward making it more convenient. And so if I think about that from an investor point of view, do I want to own the million square foot bulk distribution facility, or do I want to own more of that? I kind of don't like the phrase last mile. Do I want to own more of that last mile and kind of everything related to it from a logistics or transport point of view? I think I might, right? But that's a difficult one to get into, because now you're paying up, you got lower cap rates to be in an infill market location. You can get long, you can get better rent growth there theoretically, but if you're buying a lower cap rate building, you're already paying for a lot of that growth, especially if that lease term's a little bit longer, right? So from an investor perspective, it's a tough call. I'm not arguing for the big box product, but you're going to be paying for some amount of that future growth initially. And so it's where the focus is going to be. I just don't know if that's where you're going to deliver alpha.
When we're talking about growth and opportunity, one of the things that we're looking at with a number of different investment groups, including the investors that we primarily worked with over the years, is looking at kind of potential of like dark stores and retail and kind of retrofitting, maybe traditional retail or you know, industrial product that's from like the 50s and 60s. Is that where you see potential advantage in the market, or is it just a case by case basis?
At the end of the day, it's probably case by case, but I yeah. I really love that segment. There was a group, not to give them a shout out, but I kind of have to, Get Fabric, I think was what they were called, Fabric. They have a fully automated kind of, not necessarily the picking and packing, but a lot of the interior warehouse on the box and stuff. Everybody's doing it, but I toured their facility in the depths of COVID, and we had great conversation about them wanting to replicate that as from a 3PL perspective, but in small, call it 10,000 square foot spaces, really throughout Manhattan. They would love to be on the corner of, call it 6th Avenue and 43rd, or Broadway and Prince Street, to really kind of service that micro market. But for them, if you think about it, they're just kind of displacing that truck. I'm sure you have them in Chicago too, that Amazon truck who's parked on the street dumping boxes on, and the guys are walking packages right for that 3-block radius, 5-block radius. It's kind of annoying if you live there and you'd rather they were in that retail store. But it's expensive, right? And so they're like, it doesn't make economic sense for us. Rents would have to really, really, really come down. So I think where you might see it more, and I know Amazon Whole Foods is doing this, having it in their locations, right? And so it's part of their operating structure in that physical space, so they can do both, you know, store sales, retail sales, as well as that delivery, that last mile, kind of embedded in their operation. Yeah. Otherwise, retail rents need to adjust kind of dramatically.
Yeah, Amazon is definitely not the only one doing it. I mean, Walmart definitely is. Target definitely is. Any of these larger suppliers you're starting to see, and we've seen them come in, and we've worked on some deals with them. I'm curious, In terms of that, one of the other factors that I know that's going on and that's really pushing things, and you kind of mentioned it earlier, was energy prices. So like, how can, from a landlord or investor perspective, can we be more resilient towards potential energy fluctuations? And maybe they're going to be coming down, or maybe they'll continue to be rising. What are you starting to see in terms of like cost resiliency in the energy space?
Yeah, I love that topic. This symposium that this morning, one of the intermediaries there was saying they're really focused on trying to fundraise for what he called high tech industrial. I'm like, do you mean data centers, or do you mean industrial buildings that have a lot of robotics and energy utilization? And he was a little bit stumped, but he said the latter, really, more robotics and automation. I'm like, well, that's great. And so does the conversation of energy come up? He's like, no, it's a bullet point in the deck. I'm like, really? I'm like, so after that, and you get into the conversation, are they talking about that building's power ability? Are they talking about that local kind of block? Or are they talking about the municipality or the state's like regulatory thinking and outlook? And they're like, definitely just the building level, which I get, but you brought up the right topic. I think if I fast forward, I don't know, a couple of years, 5 years, it's a state issue. It's a municipality issue far more than it is just a building issue, right? I'm starting to gather some thoughts around a research project. If any of your listeners want to, you know, support my students on it or talk to me about it, I'd love to. Looking at state level energy policy. I'm a big fan of nuclear, especially, you know, small scale. We're not there yet, but getting there. I think, so I want to look at regulatory issues that are supportive of cheaper energy, because it is going to be an issue, if not directly vis-a-vis that high-tech industrial building or any property's usage, but really the usage and utilization across the entire grid and what that does to any given user's cost, right? I think that's going to be a more important issue that occupiers are going to start to see. And I think it came up with that retailer conversation I had earlier this week. So it's becoming an issue. How long, big of an issue it gets and where it goes, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's a huge issue in terms of AI management. I know we're working and looking through some deals potentially, and working with some clients potentially, and some opportunities at Steelworks and the Quantum development down on the south side of the city. And that there's tremendous amount of power that needs to go in there. And we're seeing that in Lake County on a couple projects that we might be involved in as well. How are you seeing kind of AI management and power issues playing out in terms of looking at allocating for funds or as an investor? Because it seems like those corridors both have a tremendous amount of opportunity, but they also have just like absolutely tremendous amount of capital expenditure to put that much power in.
Yeah, I think it's still somewhat theoretical at this point. I don't think anybody really has any good ideas know what they're looking for. So it's more conversational if it's being had. But I do know an infrastructure investor whose mandate has kind of shifted around a little bit, kind of expanded to include more things that smell like real estate to us into their mandate. But one interesting item he's focusing on, and I want to explore further, is concurrency development. So he's, as an infrastructure investor, wants to build out and pay for utilities, electricity, roads, logistics, right? And he could do that in support of larger, whether it's data center, manufacturing, warehouse, logistics development. So really taking not the property level focus, but more the municipal focus on thinking about their holistic, call it infra needs, energy, power, logistics, and I think working more hand in hand with real estate. So that's pretty exciting. And there's going to be obviously an energy component to that.
So before we get to our final four, and we'll start to wrap up with that, I've got one more question that relates to AI and energy, and you mentioned it earlier, and that's how can investors and, you know, potential landlords, as well as even occupiers, look at it long term, who are, you know, considering buying a building, kind of future proof or be resilient towards evolutions in robotics. I know there was one e-commerce group that we worked with, and we were looking at a building recently, and I realized the floor wasn't perfect enough for our tenant. And when you start going, higher and higher and higher, and this was, 32 foot clear, and you want to have robotics involved, maybe a flat floor is an absolute necessity. And so we started looking at kind of those opportunities, and I'm curious how you're seeing it play out from a fund perspective, and then kind of just generally a future proofing perspective from an academic view.
Yeah, look, it's tough because there's no single vector in the entire, we'll call it, building ecosystem, whether it's the investor, the developer, the occupier. There's no single vector that I can think of automation being the end all be all. And it's not just automation, you threw AI in there, right? So it really depends. And I think it's going to come down to cost of whatever it is utilizing tech and energy. I'm almost going to start putting those as like one and the same going forward, right? the cost of that and their creative thinking of what they can do with it. If I think about, call it a $150, $200 million top line revenue manufacturer, what can they really afford to do from high tech equipment manufacturing point of view? What do they need to do? It's going to cost them X millions of dollars to buy a piece of equipment. I don't know if they're going to get an ROI on that, right? So I don't know how much it's going to impact a lot of the industrial space market just because of that cost. It's going to be the larger tenants doing more redundant things. Maybe it's going to be, we know, on the manufacturing side and like the 1 million, 2 million square foot high-tech pharmacy and chip manufacturing facilities, sure. But those are completely different beasts than the rest of the space. And so I think it's going to all circle back to energy, right? And really having the most fungible space, right? The most rectangular space. Maybe you're going to want to focus more on thicker flooring rather than not. Maybe that's going to be more important, generally speaking. But I think it's just having a more fungible space with good access to energy. But to close that out on the cost side, I did have a conversation with somebody last week about finding more FF&E lenders to maybe provide some sort of staple financing with your lease package. So yes, I'm a landlord. I'm going to offer you a lease for X years at X rate. Yes, you got to put in a significant amount of fit out. A lot of it is high tech for whatever reason. Where are you going to get that money to pay for that? Well, maybe I, the landlord, could, but if I'm a private equity fund or, a smaller group who's doing retail funding, my cost of capital is probably not necessarily better than yours. So it's still going to be really expensive. So maybe we need to bring in a third party to do that, right? So I think there's probably a space to play for those FF&E lenders to get a little more creative on that.
So we always like to get creative at the end of the podcast. And one of the fun ways that we like to do that is kind of our final four. And it's always kind of a unique way to learn a little bit more about you, learn a little bit more about the future of the market, because this podcast is very future driven, kind of understanding where the future is going and kind of where we can adjust our portfolio around that. And so I'm curious, the first question is always future based. Where do you see real estate going, particularly industrial real estate going, over the next 10 years?
Probably not where I actually think it's going to go.
An honest man. Okay. All right. Yeah.
Look, I am, if I really put on my futuristic hat, I am incredibly bullish on energy outlook. I think if we can crack the code, so to speak, on small modular reactors, I think energy costs can get really low. And once that starts to happen, just think about everything you can do with AI and LLMs, right? I don't know how that plays into actual physical manufacturing and space utilization, but it has to translate very positively, right? So I'm very bullish on energy costs. I think there's a river we have to cross to get there. I don't know how fast that water's moving, how deep it is, how cold it is. So I don't know, but I'm bullish on that. I think the real estate participant space has gotten very professional and smart. People like you communicating, bits of granular knowledge from across the landscape, more graduate programs, more institutionalization. It's really kind of changing the way everything looks. The same conversation wouldn't have happened 15 years ago, right? And I think that's all very incremental. And it's going to change the way the space is capitalized, built, fit out, so on and so forth. So again, very bullish on that as well.
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely seeing consolidation in the space and definitely seeing a shift. I know even within the last, you know, I essentially been in the business because I'm fourth generation, working on and off in various capacities for about now 20 years. And I would say just in that short time, it's shifted so much. And so in terms of that, one of the big shifts that we like to talk about is career shifts and people that are getting into the industry and talking to that person who's 25 and just starting out. And we have a lot of them that listen to the podcast, probably 20-30% of our listener base is on the younger end. And so I'm curious, when you're starting to start out in a career, what would be the, you know, 1 minute spiel or a little bit of advice you would give somebody who's looking at entering the commercial real estate?
Yeah, I would say it's pretty much the same advice that was given to me. I didn't really appreciate it at the time. It's try a lot of different things. Play as many roles as you can in your early years. Go into brokerage, go into leasing, go into sales. You get to see a lot more. You get experience a lot more. I get it. I'm repeating it now. I didn't like that answer, you know, back in the day. But what I've discovered as a competitive amateur athlete is you've got to focus on your strengths that you enjoy in order to be successful. You don't know what you enjoy. You don't know what strengths you have until you try all sorts of different things, right? So definitely get out there and try those different things. Don't be afraid of being pigeonholed, but try to have a rationale for each of those exploratory actions. And piece them together and learn from it and build from it, because that's the power of compounding.
So speaking of compounding, and that's a wonderful bit of advice. One of the ways that we like to compound knowledge is not just dealing with people and getting out there, but learning through books. And I'm a voracious reader. If I can't always pick up a book, I pick up an audiobook. And so I'm curious, if there's a book that you could recommend that's related to commercial real estate, what's the next book that our listeners should read?
Great question. I'm not a voracious reader, I was giving some lectures over the summer and fall about the history of the REIT structure and REIT vehicle, and I have a good working knowledge of it. But in some of those conversations, somebody recommended Watch That Rat Hole by Ken Campbell. And if Ken Campbell's an old hand in the REIT space, he was the original founder of Clarion Investors. The book is kind of hard to find. And I'm not going to tell you it's a page turner. You really have to want to learn the history of the REIT structure. But it really talks about, spends great detail about the 60s, 70s, and into the 1980s about the economy, interest rates, home building, business, the structure, mortgage lending, and all those relationships. And so I'm a bit of a nerd. Literally, it was page turner for me, and I read it over the holidays. And again, it's like 40, 50, 60 year old information, but I really found that type of background motivating, but also things that I can like repurpose and use today. So I would recommend that.
Look, I would say sometimes history is the best predictor of the future in this industry. I know we've had a couple of different recommendations that I picked up, and somebody who hasn't been working in the industry for 100 years, I was surprised at when I started to see situations in our market occur based on things that had happened, you know, almost a century ago. So there's one last question, and this is like the most important question, the whole reason why we started the podcast. Oh, and that's just, if there's somebody that you could recommend to talk to next, who would that be?
Yeah, that one's kind of hard. My role at NYU, I have a couple hats over there, and I get to bring in guest speakers all the time. And I know why you're asking it. It's fantastic. Little nuggets here and there, as I said, really add up to a lot of information. I would say one of the guest speakers that I have often who has a lot of energy, who's incredibly bright and brings a different lens to real estate, but a very sharp quantitative lens with a very punchy wit. Hopefully you haven't had him, so I'm not going to be redundant to you. Hunter Hopcroft.
Yeah.
Highly recommend him. So. Okay.
Look, I'd love to have him on if we could do that. And the last question, and this is also an important question, is somebody wants to reach out and learn a little bit more about you, about what you do in real estate, what you do and role in academia. What's the best way to get in contact?
Pretty much any way. Social media is easy. LinkedIn, I'm on X. You can email me at NYU. I'll provide you all that information if you like. But yeah, I take too much time to respond to everything I get because it's worthwhile.
Scott, thank you so much for hopping on. And we have to have you on in the future.
Love it, Gordon. Appreciate it.
Thanks again to Scott. We appreciate his insights. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments, interactions, and subscriptions truly matter and help us to continue to provide quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you hear your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lanphier of the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.